what about TMI? When did you first hear about the TMI incident?
I was at the Northeastern MLA meetings in Hartford, Connecticut, and I was in a session on Willa Cather, and someone said something about, oh my gosh, look what's happened in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And I went back and looked at the Hartford reports of this, and I immediately went to my room and called campus and called Clark, and he said, there's nothing to worry about. And I said, did you know about this when I spoke to you last night? And he said, yes, but we knew there was nothing to worry about. And I couldn't believe that you weren't upset about it or you hadn't heard about it. But I thought, well, if she doesn't know, I'm not going to tell her. She'll just worry. It'll ruin her time. So I'm not going to tell her.
What day was that?
It was on Thursday morning. And it must have been on the news Wednesday evening. But I met a friend of mine, Sharon O'Brien, who... we were staying together, went to the conference together. She's been in Philadelphia this year. So we met and we went out for dinner. We had a very nice time. We hadn't seen each other for a month or so. And we were just visiting. We didn't turn on the television at all in our room and really didn't hear about it until the next morning.
Mm-hmm. So who was it exactly that you heard it from?
I don't know who the person was. It was someone in the session that was listening to the session such same way I was, but had gotten the newspaper and then opened it at the end of the session, was just looking at the front page and said, said something, and I heard Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I was, of course, knew that was close to home, and so I read it. And then from then on, I followed it very closely and really curtailed my time in Hartford, because on Friday morning I got up and the Hartford newspaper had done a scenario of the releases of information, simply reporting what had been released. And in looking at those, it became quite obvious to me that we were not being told what was going on, that there was a lot of discrepancy between what was being reported and then within, if you just looked at the news releases over a 48-hour period, you realize it. And I really was frightened by then, particularly because my children were here and I wasn't here, and we needed to evacuate. I wanted to be home, so we left, and I came home. It took me until midnight on Friday, but I got home Friday night.
So you would have stayed longer except for this?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you know that there was a reactor there at Three Mile Island before?
Oh, yes. I've often had feelings of anxiety about that reactor. And, every time I go to the airport, I look at it and I feel... Now, I sort of tend to forget it, but when I see it, I think, I've been what they're doing there, something like that. So, yeah, I knew it was there.
Do you know how far we are from it?
Well, we got various, I think we're 22 miles from it.
Uh-huh.
I had thought before that we were farther. When I called Clark, he said we were 30 miles from it.
I guess that's a discrepancy between driving and as the crow flies.
Right, yeah.
When you first heard about it, what did you think?
I was just alarmed. I didn't understand nearly as much as I did, say, 4 or 5 days afterwards, what was involved. I didn't know what was involved, and I think that was a source of anxiety for a lot of people. I just knew it was bad, and I didn't really envisage a meltdown. I couldn't have. I didn't even know what that was. I hadn't seen the Chinese syndrome then. And my fear was with radiation, and I thought, of it being, I knew it was something you couldn't taste, see, smell, or hear, and so you didn't know if this had happened to you. And that's my greatest fear, was that my children had in some way been contaminated, and no one would know, and I still have that fear.
You mentioned children a couple of times. This was your greatest fear then, was something was going to happen to your children.
Right.
Did you think that it was a a serious situation from the first time that you
right.
heard about it?
Mm-hmm.
Did you think it was like a crisis or anything?
I definitely did. Certainly a crisis for me. Yeah.
Why did you think it was so serious when it was first reported?
Well, I guess I... See, I remember I remember Hiroshima. I remember the film clips from that. And then one of my most vivid memories is an early film, Hiroshima Mon Amour. Around, I guess it's zero. No. Who did that? I can't remember. Anyway, I remember the impact of that radiation and
did you see that when you were young?
I saw the film clips, the newsreels of that when I was young, and I saw Hiroshima Mon Amour. I guess I saw that when I was fairly young, or when I was still in my 20s. And it made a great impact on me then because, I was just, my children were very young then. One of them hadn't even been born. The thought of what that meant, you know, for their lives. That we had unleashed this power in the world, and we were, you know, once again interfering with the powers of nature. So, like, it's just always been a, you know, a fear. So that when it was that close to home, I was apprehensive. I also was distrustful, increasingly distrustful of what we were being told.
Why?
Well, if you, as I say, I think that the thing that really brought it home to me was this one story in the Hartford newspaper that was simply an accounting of what was being released in terms of, you know, what the situation was. And it was obvious after, you know, 2 or 3 days of this that what MedEd was saying and what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was saying, you know, there were just, I think the most frightening thing about the whole thing at the beginning was the discrepancies between what these various agencies were saying, so that you had the sense that you really did not know what was going on. As long as you don't know, you're always going to be more fearful and apprehensive. If you don't have a feeling you can trust what's being told you. Now, I understand the people that were here on campus and were hearing from people in the physics department had a greater sense of confidence that they knew what was going on, but I wasn't here in the early hours of it, and I was very much in the feeling of getting back, you know, getting back to my children, to somehow or another, you know, and not knowing how much they had been endangered and how much danger they were in at that moment.
How did Clark react to all this?
He went off to Pittsburgh. That was another thing. Friday morning, he went to Pittsburgh. He was going to the Duquesne History Forum meetings there. And I must say, Clark always, we have a joke in our family that whatever is wrong, Clark always diagnoses it as being drainage. He says, well, this is simply drainage. If a child has a sore throat, it's drainage. If they have a cough, it's drainage. And so, you know, we don't really, and I'm on the other hand the person that says, this child has scarlet fever. Occasionally I'm right. At one point our child, Clark, diagnoses it as drainage, and I diagnosed it as scarlet fever, and I was right. But often Clark is right, that it's just drainage. So we sort of tend to be on opposite ends of the continuum between, you know, mindless security and mindless hysteria somewhere between. And he'd gotten up on Friday morning, and the news reports apparently on Friday morning were very reassuring that it was very much under control, that it was actually cooling down.
Mm-hmm.
And so he left.
Do you think that he was more confident because he was here?
I guess so. I guess so. I guess he knew something of what the college was saying about it. And, of course, he didn't go to that meeting that I heard so much about, the Friday afternoon meeting, because he was gone by then. Mm-hmm. But, of course, everything, I think here, from my interviews, what I was able to reconstruct about what was going on here, people didn't really become alarmed until Friday afternoon. So my alarm was, I think, maybe triggered by being away from here and not knowing it, and it not being a central story. I mean, it was a big story, but it wasn't, you know, it was what these people in central Pennsylvania were suffering if you weren't here. But those were my people, and so I wanted to be back. So I think my anxiety was increased by being away. But anyway, he went away on Friday morning, and I got back Friday night. And Saturday morning, I called him and told him to come home, and he did, because he could tell I was really panicked.
Well, what's interesting to me is that you are able to reconstruct this all so carefully and accurately. You know what went on Friday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday morning, at all these different times you can remember it.
Yeah, so well, it was very vivid. Uh-huh. It was very vivid to me. I keep a journal, so mm-hmm. I would tend to, although interestingly enough, I don't do this in an orderly fashion, and I had been being very orderly from Christmas until that time, and it just might have a big break in my journal then for the next. I just stopped keeping it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Do you think it had anything to do with the crisis?
Yeah, it did. I don't know why, but I just quit writing.
Have you gone back to it?
No. I'm just getting myself ready to start a new kind of journal that I've been sort of been contemplating doing, called an intensive journal. And I need some time and space to start it, so I'm waiting until the 23rd of July, which is my first day of vacation. I have some time away from it, so I can sort of get my thoughts together.
Are you going to write about the crisis at all?
I probably will. There's another crisis in my life right now that I'm really working through. It has to do with my job. It has not to do with this. So, yeah. Paper.
You said you won't forget the face of the woman who had the newspaper. Yeah. What? Was she very upset or anything?
No, but I just looked at her. It's like, don't you ever have those spots in time that you look and you know you're always going to, sometimes I say to myself, I'm always going to remember this, and sometimes I don't, but I always remember it. They're like little spots in time that I have in my life.
Is it because something is tremendously important or impressive, or what?
Sometimes
is
it is, and sometimes it isn't. Mm-hmm. Once when I was a little kid, I was eating a piece of cake, sitting on the back porch, and the screen door slammed shut. It's so vivid in my mind, and there's no significance to that, except my grandfather was visiting, and that he was a very important person, but I don't know why I remember that. But this, well, I'll remember, because just her face, the fact that she was saying this to me, and she had, you know, like, she was an other person. She was reporting something to me that had no significance. I mean, it had interest to her, but it wasn't. She didn't even know where Harrisburg, Pennsylvania was.
Well, do you remember other crises, past crises like that? You said that you always remembered Hiroshima, for instance, the film clips of it. Do you remember those crises?
I think the Hiroshima was a media crisis for me, the way TMI was a media crisis for a lot of people. I mean, it was something that had an impact on me through the media, through the news clips in the theaters. We didn't have television then, you know, so they'd have these news reels at the theater, and I saw clips from those. And hearing about it. It was a really strange feeling, too, because even though I was a child, you knew that it was a terrible thing that we'd done. It was wonderful in that the war was going to come to an end, but it was terrible because of the way it was coming to an end. I remember having very ambivalent feelings about it. I don't know if I would have characterized them as ambivalent feelings, but I remember thinking, this is good and bad.
Why did you think it was bad? What was it about it that you thought
well,
was bad?
Well, what it was doing to the people, I mean, and the insidious nature of radiation. You know, the insidious nature of what it doesn't happen to you. I mean, the people that were, of course, right there were killed, but the people in the countryside, and, you know, it's like having a time bomb in your body, not knowing how long it will be before you pay the price, but knowing you're going to probably pay the price. Now, I think we all have, to some extent, that time bomb in our bodies now. We don't know. I mean, I still don't.
From TMI, do you mean, or from...
Mm-hmm. I don't think that we know. And heavens, we've got all that nuclear waste still sitting over there. And this, whether or not, this debate about whether or not to put it in the Susquehanna. We live in the Limestone Valley. If we put this in the Susquehanna, we're going to get it in our, you know, I mean, it's just a question of time before we get it in the water supply in the whole valley. It's madness. Now you have Peach Bottom, and, you know, we're just, but there's no way you can escape from it. It's all over. It's sort of like the Garden of Eden all over again, you know. Once again, man has, in his pride, you know, taken on more knowledge, but his knowledge is always incomplete. Doesn't know what the ultimate implications of this knowledge are for generations of people.
Have you thought about radiation much before?
No, I don't think I... You know, I mean, it isn't... Well, those of us who are at Dickinson have thought about it because of Priscilla Laws, about the dangers of X-ray and that sort of thing. I don't suppose I've thought about it anywhere near my house.
I just bring it up because you mentioned it in connection with Hiroshima, and you thought about the insidious nature of radiation and that sort of thing, and then talking about the radiation problem from TMI, I was just wondering if you've had some particular thoughts about radiation in general, or has the idea of radiation affected you and your thinking or your life in any way?
I don't know really how to answer that. I don't know. I mean, it obviously came to a head in Three Mile Island.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think it's, I think that any person who's reading about changes in our environment is aware of the fact that since the end of certainly since the end of World War II, we've introduced so many chemical changes in our environment, and I don't know if you characterize radiation as a chemical change in the environment. I'm not that much of a scientist, but it's part of a whole, you know, raft of pollutants that we've put into the environment. So that, I guess I'm aware of that and of the inescapability of it from my man.
Okay, we'll take up the idea of radiation a little bit later. When you first heard about the TMI crisis, did you try to go get more information anywhere?
Yes, well, I just bought the newspapers every time they came out, and then I went to the television, listened to the news. The worst day for me was really Friday, because it's very hard to get from Hartford, Connecticut to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And there were no flights coming in to Harrisburg. So I took a train from Hartford to Philadelphia. And it was a long train ride, and it was the longest that I'd been away from a television or radio to see what was going on. When we came into...
How long was it?
We got the train about 1 o'clock in Hartford, and we got into Philly about 5 o'clock, and we walked into the Philadelphia train station, and there's this Philadelphia Bulletin. It's an irresponsible newspaper. I would never read. I mean, I read the Inquirer, but the Bulletin had this headline, Thousands Flee. And I went to pick up the newspaper, and I went to pick up the paper, and apparently as I picked up the paper, this is another one of those little weird incidences, a man was getting his paper, and he dropped his dime, and my foot went on his dime. And it was one of those things where I wanted to read that paper, and he was saying, "You've got your foot on my dime, you've got your foot on my dime." And I felt like saying, "Come on, let me read this." I was desperate to get some information. Well, it was very frightening, and Sharon was trying to calm me down. She said, don't read the bulletin, you know. I was supposed to stay in Philadelphia with her that night, but I decided right then that I was going to go right home. But we went back to her apartment, and I called Lana, because I knew Clark wasn't there, and that was a very calming influence, because she had been to the Friday afternoon meeting, and they agreed to come to... I was very apprehensive about asking them to come to meet my train, because I didn't want to endanger them. They felt that they would be endangered by coming into Harrisburg. But they assured me that they wouldn't be, and I came back in.
Did you feel at all uneasy about coming in through Harrisburg?
Well, I felt uneasy about it, but it's one of those things, like if you're a mother and you want to get to your children, it's just something that you just do. You just don't think about it. You know, it was funny, when I bought the ticket in Philadelphia, people said to me, "You don't want to go to you don't want to go to Harrisburg." And they were saying, on the train, they were saying, "All aboard for Three Mile Island," you know, that sort of thing, getting on the train. And it was really funny, because when we were in Sharon's apartment, she lives with a couple who he teaches at the University of Pennsylvania, and they said, "You're back from your meeting. Well, at least you weren't going to Harrisburg." And Sharon said, "Oh, well, be quiet. Peggy's going to Harrisburg." It was just like, "Oh, why are you going to Harrisburg?" But my anxiety was to get there and to somehow or another get in control of the situation for my children and my family, so that I wasn't really very worried about myself in terms of getting there. I just knew I had to get there. In fact, I looked out the window when we went by, you know, to see if I could see it. And I was just anxious to get home.
Well, your train goes right past
right
Canada,
right.
Mm-hmm. It goes through Goldsboro, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah.
Who said "all aboard for 3 Mile Island"? The conductor or what?
Yeah.
So they were joking already.
Yeah, they were joking already about it. Yeah.
What was the atmosphere like on the train?
A lot of people get off before you. It's just a commuter train, really. It's just a milk train, kind of horrible. Looks like it was done in the time of Franklin or Lincoln. You know, this really ancient train and hard seats, and people get off all the way. You know, getting off. And by the time we got to Goldsboro, there were only about three or four people on the train, and they were all older men. One of them, someone who had been in Pittsburgh and was going to Harrisburg and couldn't get back, had to take a plane from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia and the train back to Harrisburg to get home, because there were no flights in. And so, you know, people going home, having the same experience I was, and fairly stoic about it. I mean, you know, looking at it, we all looked, and very little conversation about it, you know, I mean, aware of it, but everybody pretty much, I think, sort of working on their own, what their own situation was, and not too much conversation. My own feelings were kind of funny. I think I saw the whole thing much more in the context of World War II than any other previous experience, and one of my vivid memories of World War II, one of the anxieties that I felt about the war, were anxieties of separation. One of the things that I used to spend hours doing when I was a little girl was playing as if I were Madame Chiang Kai-shek. and who was a great culture hero for me. And what I would do is I'd take all my paper dolls and I would just dump them and mess them all up. And this was my idea of war. Everybody all messed up. And then I would be the Red Cross, or I would be Madame Chiang Kai-shek, and I would reestablish the families. That was how I would, you know, bring this order. And I would spend hours, like this would be a whole day's game, start in the morning with great chaos. And the object of the game was to relocate all the families throughout the day. And that was kind of my feeling, you know, like I was doing that again. I was relocating, I was getting on a train, I was going someplace to get my family centralized and prepared to deal with whatever they had to deal with. And so it was sort of I felt very World War II-ish as I was riding on that train. Sort of role-playing, I guess, to get me through, sort of stoicism or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Were people, just because of my own line of interest, were people joking more? I mean, besides the solid board for Three Mile Island, or was that sort of it?
There wasn't too much conversation. I wasn't aware of conversation.
Were the conductors kind of nervous about it?
They didn't seem to be. You know, they were, I would say everybody was pretty stoic about what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, it was what choice did they have? This was their job, and they were doing it, you know. And there were some comments made, but actually, just as we got onto the train in Philadelphia, those remarks, and then just as we went past the site, and as we got into Harrisburg, you know, but there were just two or three of us then, and people were just making, you know, it's still there, it hasn't blown up yet, you know, that sort of thing. Not really too much humor.
You think it was what they were saying was for reassurance?
Pretty much.
Were you more worried as you passed it?
Mm-mm. I was relieved because I was getting closer to home. You know, I knew I had to do it, and that's what I wanted to do.
How did Lana and Richard react driving in?
Richard came by himself, and in the time, either they didn't choose to tell me, and I've never really asked them this, or they didn't really understand about it, but between the time I talked to them on the phone from Philadelphia to the time I got there, the bubble had emerged, and that was a new crisis. And so Lana had stayed in Carlisle. Well, they have two small children. They couldn't just both come off anyway and leave the children. But she'd stayed to watch the developments in the news. So I got back, and one of the other complicating factors for me was where my children were. Margaret was supposed to stay with a family in Carlisle that I called from Philadelphia to tell them that I was coming back into town, so that they'd know that. I didn't know how panicked people were here, you know. I didn't know what the state of things were, and I thought I'd better check in. I knew that Margaret was at her ballet class and that I couldn't talk to her. So I called the Palmers, and they were leaving town that evening. Now, the reasons they were leaving were somewhat complicated by the fact that their father was with them. He was very old and very apprehensive, and they were afraid that it would trigger, you know, a heart attack or something. So they were taking him out of the area, and he would not go unless they took everyone in the family. And they said they would take Margaret with them and go out of the area. That was really a hard decision for me to make, because I felt that she'd be safer if she went, but then she'd be far away from me, and I was trying to get us all in a central location. So I told them to have her, to call her and tell her that I would be in, and that I would either come out and get her that night. I didn't know when my train would get in, but to stay with her ballet teacher, which she's done before. So Richard and I went out to the ballet school, and there was a note on the screen: Margaret's asleep and she's spending the night. So I had no one at home except my animals to take care of. They were there. And I went back and had tea with Richard and Lana, and we just sort of talked about, they went over everything that had been going on campus, what was the wise decision to make about leaving, and then I went home, and we agreed that we would not either of us leave without telling the other one we'd be in touch, which was very reassuring to me because I was there in the house by myself, and I didn't, and everyone was everywhere, you know.
Were they particularly nervous, do you think, or were they,
calmer
than you thought?
They were more nervous when I got there than they were when I talked to them on the phone, and it was because of the bubble. Lana was very reassuring. Of course, Lana has a way of being reassuring when she... I was pretty hysterical when I called her from Philadelphia. I was really upset. I don't think I ever was again as upset as I was then. Mm-hmm. And she was primarily directing her attention to calming me down. She seemed very much in control. By the time I got there, they were having a kind of conflict about who, you know, whether they should go or whether they should stay. And they'd flip-flop, you know. They'd sort of, one of them would say, well, we should go, and the other would say, no. And then, you know, it was sort of, it wasn't all one-sided, you know, it wasn't a clear-cut argument, but they would take different positions. And I think we all stayed in that frame of mind. I stayed in that frame of mind until Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm. About whether to go.
Whether to go, when to go.
When was Clark going to come back?
I called him then the first thing I got up, I called him, it must have been 6 o'clock Saturday morning, and told him I wanted him to come home. He got home around noon on Saturday. And went to the bank first thing Saturday morning and got money. And I filled the car up with gas. And
you didn't take all your money out of the bank?
No, I just took, I can't remember, I think I took maybe $150, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I got gas. I put all the photo albums in the car and the litter box for the cat. I didn't know how I was going to get everybody out in this car. We only have an Omni. We have a golden retriever, a very noisy Siamese type cat. And then we have the children. I was going to get them all in, but I decided the thing to take. There was nothing to take from the house. I mean, there was either everything or nothing, and that I would just take the photograph albums or the records of the children's growing up. That's what I'd take. And the slides. I took those. And so I was ready to go. That was all I was going to take. From that point on. More than a half hour, though. You know,
the things that were most important to you. You took your pictures and your slides.
That's all. I decided that there wasn't any. It's really funny too because if this had happened maybe 6 months earlier, I'd have taken all my notes from my dissertation. But all of a sudden, it really didn't matter anymore about that. I mean, I had it somewhere on microfilm, I guess, or something like that. You know, it didn't. Uh-huh. It was finished, so there wasn't any other thing. At times like that, you really get your priorities in order. You know, I'm a great one for material possessions. My Sheridan chairs are a big joke in the family. Mother's Sheridan chairs. But at that moment, they seemed very inconsequential. The only thing that seemed worth preserving was a record of our family. And the animals and the children, of course.
Did you actually load up the car then with all this stuff?
Yes, I put all that stuff in the car. I mean, and it really wasn't that much. I just put the pictures and the slides in, and then I devised a way to take the cat. I realized that was going to be a problem, but I realized that the children would not go unless we took the animals. And so I had to...
So you did get everything packed up into the car.
Right.
And you had the gas tank topped up
right,
and everything.
Right.
Where were you going to go?
That became a great crisis because, as Saturday went on, I got more and more people under my control.
like the mother hen that I am. So mm-hmm. I got Clark home, and Margaret and Susan were all at home. And I had succeeded in so alarming my daughter Amy. I called her from Philadelphia. I was very busy the hour or so between my train in Philadelphia. I made lots of long-distance phone calls, let me tell you. And I called my daughter at Bucknell because the original plan was that they were coming home for spring break and that they were going to drive down from Lewisburg to Harrisburg on Saturday morning and meet my train. And I didn't want her, one of the reasons I wanted to get home is that I didn't want her coming into the Harrisburg area to meet my train. And so I called her and I said, I'm going to be home tonight and Richard's meeting my train. You're not to meet my train. And in fact, I don't think you ought to come in Harrisburg because the only way to get from Lewisburg to Carlisle is to come down the river and then pick up 81. And I didn't want her to come in that area. I said, why don't you go to John's house? Why don't you go to Waynesboro, which is where her young man lives? And can you go some other way? Can you get there some other way? And John is a physical chemist and a scientist, and he was not concerned about this. But Amy is the daughter that's most likely to be influenced by my hysteria. So I managed to get her so riled up that she called John in the middle of the night and they evacuated and went to Waynesboro that day. So I had Amy in Waynesboro with her dog. The dog was in Waynesboro, the cat and the other two children and Clark were in Carlisle. I still didn't have everybody together. And I knew that wherever we went, we had to go west. My brother-in-law, the only person in the family, and this is another thing that was really unfortunate for me about Three Mile Island, is that both Clark's parents and my parents were totally, seemingly unconcerned about the danger. They did not share my sense of anxiety about it at all. And didn't
they live far away?
Clark's parents were in Florida at the time, and my parents lived in Chicago. And his parents lived in Chicago, too, but they weren't there. Neither of them initiated any phone calls to us to see how we were doing. And the only person in the family was my brother-in-law in Boston who called and said, come, you can stay here, you can stay as long as you need to stay. You may have to stay indefinitely, but you can come. Clark didn't feel that that was a good thing to do. He wanted to get us a day away, someplace a day away.
You mentioned west. How come west?
The reason I thought west is that Amy was west, and we'd go west to get her. And then I thought of going to Chicago. And actually, on Sunday morning when I decided that it was foolishness to stay any longer and that I was going to leave, regardless of whether or not Clark was going to leave, because he had decided in some strange and misplaced loyalty to Dickinson College, which I could not understand, given some of his attitudes toward the college. He was not going to leave because the faculty weren't leaving. I had gotten to the point where I was going to take the children and leave. And I called my mother, told her that I was coming, and her reception to that was anything but generous. She didn't think that I should. She sort of said, well, all right. But she didn't think that I should come with the animals. She thought I should leave the animals. And I told her, I said, well, I know it would be impossible for the children to go if I leave the animals. And so I just didn't really know where I was going to go. And I think that also contributed to my anxiety. I didn't have a feeling that there was any one place that I could go. And I think the thing that happened that sort of calmed me down was somehow or another, I went to church on Friday or Sunday morning, and then after church, I decided to make my decision after that. I came back, and I somehow became more calm, and Amy, my daughter that was in Waynesboro, who is probably most sensitive to my moods, had, I think, decided that I was probably more upset because we weren't all together, so she decided to come home. And somehow or another, when I got everybody in Carlisle, I got calmer. At least we were all in one place. If we decided to go, we could all go together. And that was very, you know, calming. And then the Nuclear Regulatory Commission information at 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon was much more reassuring. And by then, I had begun to really at least trust that body's information, what they were giving out. I was deciding it was at least more reliable than MedEd, and that, you know, that you could put some credence in it. I don't know. So.
That's interesting. What did you think about the college's decision, for instance?
I thought it was irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the attitude that I could detect in the administration, that their primary responsibility was to maintain order, was a kind of game that they were playing with the students' lives. And I made a statement to that effect in the meeting that the college had on Saturday evening, because the students, many of the students here, had no means of transportation if the place was going to have to be evacuated. And the college really doesn't have the facilities to transport a large numbers of people out of the area. And this idea that somehow or another, if Dickinson College closed, it would cause the county to panic, I found absurd. I don't think that the community was paying any attention, particularly what the college was doing. And I felt that the students' well-being was the primary consideration of the institution in that regard, that as many students as could be moved out of here in an orderly fashion and restored to their families at that time, I think that should have been done. I think that actually happened because the college saw that families were going to require that their children come home, and many children left.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately what happened was, was fine. But I think that that there was some kind of a little game being played about being orderly and maintaining, being generals on the front. I found it all very militaristic and rational and male.
Mm-hmm. I think I understand what you mean. What do you think the college should actually have done? Do you think it should have just closed?
I think that, of course, I wasn't here until late on Friday, so I feel like I can't really speak during the times I wasn't here, because my information was fragmentary, and I don't know what was really going on. But I would have said that by Saturday, that the college, what the college should have done was to encourage students to leave, saying that classes would. I think the decision that they actually made on, I guess it was Sunday afternoon, that was a good decision. I just think that it probably should have been made.
Mm-hmm. So all of your students that you saw on Saturday, you did encourage to leave?
I did.
And did they leave?
I think they did. I don't have that many students, but I have like my Nisbet students that I have responsibility for. Mm-hmm. And those that were left on campus, for some reason or other, spoke with me and left.
What do you think the reaction was of the students themselves? How did you perceive it?
It's hard to say. I think that some students felt that they wanted to be told what to do, and I could appreciate that. You know, it's always comforting to be told what to do, and it's always hard to try and figure it out for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some students were genuinely interested in what was going on here and didn't want to leave because they thought it was somewhat exciting.
And then I think there were some students who had anxiety as long as the college was in session. You know, we have this incredible obsession with grades at Dickinson. And I think it was really dramatized in that tension that it exacted on in certain students' lives, because if the college was still in session and they would get behind in their work if they went home, then their grades might subsequently suffer for the semester. And I think that was a real anxiety.
What about your perception of the other faculty members?
Well, there were a lot of people that I was in contact with on the telephone most of Saturday. I heard a generalization, I don't know if you heard this or not, that the people, Truman Bullard said, did he say this to you, that the people who were the performing, people in the performing arts left and the faculty who were, you know, more in academic discipline stayed. But one of the people that I spent a lot of time talking to and counseling with was Alan Krantz, who is a guitarist, and he left. And I talked a lot to Lana and Richard, and they were very torn about whether to leave or not. I talked to Gloria and George Rhine. One of the reasons I spoke a lot with Gloria is that George Rhine was with Clark in Pittsburgh, so we were kind of comparing notes there, and with the Forbeses. The people that I talked to were for the most part, torn about what to do, generally with the husbands deciding to stay and the wives thinking that people should go.
Why do you think there was that split?
I think women have less pride I might even say false pride when it comes to matters of life and death. And I think that women saw this as a life and death kind of thing, particularly because of, in some ways, women are really very outside of the establishment in the United States, even though there's all this hoopla about women's liberation and all that. And there weren't any women who were involved in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. There were no women involved in making the policy decisions in regard to the governor's office, and they were not visible if there were any, and I doubt very seriously if there were any. It's the sort of the male world of order and reason, and then there's a feminine world of caring for children and caring for life, and I think that's the difference. I wouldn't have said that before that happened. I don't think I would have really thought that much. I would have thought, gee, women are making more impact now in the world of business and work and all that. But I think at that moment there was a real division. And I think that women don't feel ultimately a loyalty to institutions. That they feel loyalty to their people, to their children, to their kin, and not to institutions.
So this is what you brought up before about the college reacting more in a male way than anything else.
Mm-hmm. My reactions to the college were, I think, feminine in that what I was concerned about were the people in the college, the students, and those people that I saw that were really anguished about what was going on. And there were people that were, but those weren't the people that were making the decisions.
Do you feel that there was any difference between the reactions, say, between the male students and female students? Do you got the difference in the faculty?
No, I didn't really. I didn't really feel that, but I have to say that two of the male students that I know the best that are that I talked to sometime during that weekend are both what I would call very well integrated into their feminine and masculine aspects. They aren't, you know, they have a nice balance of their in their personalities. I think that they were concerned and interested, and I don't think that they were typically male or in their orientation. So I couldn't make a generalization. I don't know. Do you know if there were statistics? Were there more male students that stayed than women students?
This is something we have to look into.
Yeah, I don't know.
Why ultimately didn't you leave?
Well, I think that one of the things, it's really hard to, I had a change in my whole mental attitude on Sunday. Part of that had to do with the fact that I went to church and I had a sense of tranquility from that I hadn't had before. Part of it had to do with the fact that Amy came home and I had everyone together. And part of it had to do with the fact that at 3 o'clock on Sunday, the reports from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission were much more, they were reassuring in that they weren't saying everything is fine. They were much more, they began to be much more factual about what the odds were and what the situation was in terms of. And then I think part of the reason was that I really didn't want to leave Clark. It would have been just as horrible then if I'd taken the children and left Clark here. If I couldn't get everyone to go. You know. So I think it was just a combination of factors. And I began to feel much more calm. I think that by Sunday night was the first night that Friday night and Saturday night, I slept with the radio on all night, and I woke up constantly to listen to it. But on Sunday night, we turned it off when we went to bed, and they didn't turn it on until the next morning. And then on Monday, the bubble began to shrink. And that seemed to be less of a, you know, things began to seem. And people were less anxious because, at Dickinson, I think, because of the decision the administration took on Sunday. So that no one was here that didn't, unless they really wanted to, their own free will. There weren't any constraints on their being here. Except, perhaps, ironically, for people who were in the administration, no one ever told them they could leave.
Did a lot of those people in the administration or in the...
No one in the administration left that I know of, except Jack Henderson, I think, was gone for a while. And that's because they have a child who's been subject to a lot of radiation and they wanted to get her out of the area. And they took her away. Mm-hmm. But that's the only person that I was aware of that left.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked a lot about the Dickinson community. What about the Carlisle community? Non-Dickinson people.
You know, it was really, really hard for people in the Carlisle community that I know. One person in particular owns his own business. The decision to leave, if you own your own business, is really a very dangerous one because you have to close your business. That's your means of livelihood. And then if, you know, and there were conversations about what would happen if everyone evacuated and then people come in and loot and that sort of thing. And I think in this person's case, he just felt that he couldn't risk it. He's just made a change in his business, a sort of expansion. He's in sort of one of those tenuous periods where, you know, he's not quite on the stable footing, and I don't think he could afford to go. He didn't feel that he could. And they're very close friends of ours. They go to our church, and we actually spent most of Sunday with them. feeling, sort of trying to mutually support them and get their support. We spent a lot of time together, and we were able to laugh about it, and that was a great tension relief. I mean, we began to by Sunday afternoon, talk about the sort of the more bizarre and ridiculous aspects of it, and what we were going to do and how we were going to cope. And Sandy, the wife, made various remarks about how she and I would pack up and let the rest of them stay here. And so, but I think in the community, depending on the person's occupation, and how much they were felt that they were tied to their job, how much freedom they had to act for themselves, there was a lot of tension in the community. This is also true of the people at the War College. There's a lot of anxiety there. People that we know that are on post said some very funny things, not funny, haha, but sort of strange things like, well, we're always the last to know, and we don't know any more than anybody else. Whereas people in town who knew people on post said, let's watch people on post. If they leave, then we know we should leave. It was really kind of funny. But I think that there's a lot of tension and a lot of anxiety within families. And I think that the male-female thing did from the people that I know, did persevere in those families that I know that are either Carlisle people or post people. That the women primarily felt that they should leave, and that the men felt some responsibility to stay. And so this causes within families tensions of how to resolve that. And so I think that was one of the roughest parts of the whole thing.
Did any of your friends leave? Actually take off and leave?
Yes.
How many?
Of people that I know, very close friends, who left for a long period of time, only two. Then other people left.
Two separate groups or a couple?
Yeah, two, and in both cases, well, one, the woman is divorced, and she left with her children and went to Pittsburgh. In the other case, it was a very close friend, the wife left with the children, and the husband stayed.
And his job or something.
And then I know some other people who left just for the day. A lot of people seem to leave on Sunday. I think one of the reasons for that is that the tension by Sunday was just incredibly high. And just to get away. And I know several families who just went away for the day. And with the idea, in one case particularly, they packed and that they went to Washington, and they decided that if they didn't feel that they wanted to come back, they wouldn't have to, and that they'd go on. They're from Virginia, and they'd go on down the valley. But several just taking the day to get away and then came back.
That's interesting. So they just left for Sunday and then came back Sunday
mm-hmm.
night?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you mentioned before was that you were sitting around already on Sunday with these other friends, and then you were already able to joke about it
mm-hmm.
by Sunday. You weren't able to joke until then.
Mm-mm. Not until late Sunday.
And then you started to joke.
Mm-hmm.
And then you said you started saying all sorts of joking about the bizarre and ridiculous aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's just the powerlessness of it. Just the fact that we have this illusion that we control our lives, that we order our own existence, that we maintain this illusion by such decisions as what to put on in the morning, what to serve the children for breakfast. What to have for dinner, in our jobs, what tasks to undertake for that day. So we preserve in our own minds and our own lives the idea that in some sense we control our lives and our destiny.
And then this sort of bizarre and sort of that somehow or another some person in a nuclear energy plant in on the Three Mile Island in the Susquehanna River, and because he didn't understand, or because perhaps the plant was rushed into production to get a tax deduction, or because somehow or another the cost, relatively meaningless cost to Med-Ed of having to get power someplace else, weighing against the dangers that they were inflicting on the community, because of some mindless kind of decision that was made by someone you didn't even know, you suddenly realized that you had very little control over your life. It's the stuff of which a certain kind of black humor is made, I guess. You know, I can't think of anything that we said at the time that was particular, but we began to laugh, you know, we began to laugh about it. One of the things, we got together ostensibly to watch a showing of the C.S. Lewis, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which was being shown. Lewis is an Episcopalian, he's an Anglican, and this is a story that I suppose many people will read, but it's particularly a story that if you've raised your children in the Episcopal Church, Lewis's stories are this is a way that you talk about religious ideas with children when they're very young. And our church, in fact, was jointly sponsoring this, and so that's one of the reasons why we got our children together and as families watched this, and we're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. That was the ostensible reason for getting together that evening, and we laughed and we talked about this that got us away, and then we getting away were able to, you know, make some jokes about what the situation was. Mm-hmm.
Did you joke more afterwards also?
I mean, after we saw the...
Oh, yes.
I can hardly believe how absolutely, how easily I am persuaded that things are... I want things to be right, and how easily I am persuaded that things are right, so that by... Well, what day was it that we all made the T-shirts?
Monday or Tuesday. Wednesday?
Yeah, I think it was later in the week. Because I know that on Tuesday, several people said, why don't you think of a T-shirt? And I said, I'm really not ready to do that yet. But by Wednesday, I had this idea. And I went over and designed my own T-shirt. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have done that. Of course, that's, you know, one of the things, if you're a student of literature, you realize that you can only joke and you can only make satiric comments. You can when you feel secure. You can't do this. There has to be some base of security before you can be free to laugh. There has to be some distance also. When you're very frightened or when you're very sad or, you know, you're grieving, right? When you're in a situation, you can't joke about it, I think.
Why not? What do you think the mechanism is?
I think it's distance. At least it is for me, and I think it's true in literature. For example, there are very few poets who are humorous poets in a period that takes itself seriously, like the Romantic period. There's very little humor in the Romantic poets. The only poet who really has a consistently humorous vein of the English Romantic poets is Byron. And I think that interestingly enough, that Byron is the closest to the 18th century of the Romantic poets. And he is the least caught up in the romantic sensibility. He does it as a kind of posturing in things like Manfred. But that's part of his personality, mm-hmm. you know, just romantic. He, of course, Manfred is a typical romantic hero, you know, the Byronic hero. I think you have to have distance from something. I think if you're very serious about something, it's very difficult for it to be humorous.
Well, what about all the black humor that started right with this, right with the crisis, and people were joking about it right in the midst of it all?
Mm. But what's the quality of that humor?
Does that make a difference?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it does.
What do you mean by quality of the humor?
Well, for example, great comedy. Like Don Juan, Byron's poem, or some of Shakespeare's comedies, that doesn't come in the moment. That comes with reflection, with distance from the moment. A kind of thing that happens. Flip remarks that's not really great humor. It's not. You know, it's a.
But it's humor nonetheless.
It's humor, but it's not art. I guess we're talking about, you know.
Do you think that art was that type of humor eventually did come out of this period?
Of the Romantic period?
No, of the period of the Three Mile Island.
I haven't seen any yet.
Uh-huh.
I haven't seen anything. I think the most artistic things that I've seen about it were actually reflections that were written by essayists, and they were not particularly humorous, although they might have had some ironic kinds of undertones to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I read several pieces in the New Yorker that I thought were pretty good, but I think it's too soon for anything, for example, a play to come out of it.
Well, what about just the people themselves? How would you characterize their own humor?
I think the humor in that you discovered at the heart of the situation was for most people was an alternative to some other kind of deviant behavior. I mean, humor is a kind of deviant behavior, right?
Uh-huh. But what do you mean by alternative to some other kind of
behavior? What do you have to do? You have to be acceptable. You have to be, even today, when standards for behavior are much more broadly defined than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go to work, do your job, eat your three meals a day, you know, and talk rationally about these things. Particularly in an academic community, you have to talk rationally about it. Reason on what do you think the chances are, that sort of thing. Okay, you can only do that if you're under tension for so long. Then you have to do something else. So you can either make a joke about it, and that relieves some of the tension and hints at the dark underside of your experience.
Mm-hmm.
And all those jokes did. All those flipper jokes and all that are just fears for the same kind of thing that I was talking about and could talk about, you know, now being removed from it, about the possible genetic damage to my children's children.
Mm-hmm.
And or else you could cry. Or you could rage. But those aren't acceptable forms of behavior.
Do you think there was a difference between, you mentioned the difference between men and women before, do you think there was a difference between their behavior, say, with the joking, the crying, and the raging, or something like this?
I think I would imagine, I would just guess, and I don't have any, you know, but I would imagine that probably that men were able to joke about it more rapidly than women.
Why?
Well, I think that they are more caught in the kind of, well, humor is a more acceptable kind of deviant behavior than raging and crying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that everything in their environment, everything in their experience makes them teaches them that they have to be, they have to behave in a certain way. It's not appropriate for a man to show fear. It's not and to make a joke is to demonstrate how brave you are, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice this going on at the time? Did you notice that men were reacting more that way and women were reacting?
The men that I... Now, this isn't just... there are exceptions, but the men that I talked to were much more intent on behaving in a way that demonstrated that they were in control of the situation, which I found ludicrous because they obviously weren't. And the women that I talked to were more generally admitting that they weren't in control of the situation, and by doing that were not behaving in a socially acceptable way. They were saying, my God, what is going on? What are we going to do? What are you going to do? What should I do? I don't know what to do. You know, what will this do to our children? Where are your children? What are you going to do with them? This is a kind of, this is a little bit out of control behavior.
Mm-hmm. When you were looking at the people who were staying and going, you mentioned some people in the community were looking at the people on the post and saying, if they leave, we'll leave. Was there anybody in your life that was particularly important during this time? Somebody that you were watching in order to, you know, if they left, you leave, or in any other sense that you were watching for?
I wanted Clark to leave with me. I didn't want to leave without him. So what he was thinking was very important to me all the time, what he made of what was going on. But I think that I have this sort of radical thing that happens in my head when I and this happens periodically to me. I get to a point where I look at what's going on around me and I say, regardless of what's going on around me, I'm going to do what I think I should do. So that had I decided to leave, I would out of a sense of agreement that I made with certain people in town. I certainly would have informed them that I was leaving. I wouldn't have left without informing them. But I was really going to make, I felt very strongly that I had to make up my own mind about it. But I wouldn't have left unless I could have taken all the children. And I probably wouldn't have left without Clark. I came very perilously close to leaving without him.
Was there anybody in any official capacity that you found particularly reliable? Whose word you trusted more than others? Someone that that you listened to, try to get information from?
I listened to the radio that I've forgotten what it's the. It's the station that has that terrible man on in the morning. What's his name? I discovered him actually during 3 Mile Island. Ron Drake?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there was one other time we had a little crisis here, much less of a crisis, but that was during the flood. And
During Agnes.
During Agnes, that same radio station was very reliable about giving. News bulletins that were fairly complete and gave you the sense that if you were going to get any kind of information from any place, that you would get it there. And that is really the only station that I listened to. I didn't find that for example, the national media, I didn't feel was particularly responsible about it. It was a news story to them. But for the people that were broadcasting out of Harrisburg, it was more than a news story. It was where they were. Those reporters were there. And I subsequently spoke to one of those reporters who turned out to have been a Dickinson graduate. And you know, they were putting their lives on the line, some of them felt, by staying there and continuing to broadcast. I listened to that station, and particularly whenever they
broadcast the report of the man from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I listened to him and to their report. And I think that I made most of my decisions based on that. I did take into consideration what the physicists at Dickinson were saying. I mean, I found interesting and reassuring, but I didn't watch to see if Priscilla Law's car was going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel that was fair to her, and I felt like I would rather make my own mind up on to go.
Was there anybody that you particularly mistrusted? Or any group that you really mistrusted?
Well, Met Ed, of course. The villain. I must say that I in the college, I certainly mistrusted President Banks and George Allen. I wasn't paying any attention to what they had to say.
Why was that? Was that because of?
That's because I had made the I felt that they were not tuned into what was really going on. They were playing some kind of a war games.
You know what we were talking about before. Why did you mistrust Med Ed? It may be a very obvious reason, but I just want to know.
Well, one of the reasons I mistrusted Med Ed is that the early news releases were before the Nuclear Regulatory Commission came in and began to make these news releases were from Med Ed, and time demonstrated that they were faulty and inconsistent and many times contradictory. And then I think it was by Saturday morning, you were getting dual news releases, one from Med Ed and one from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission within, say, 15 or 20 minutes of one another, and there was always a discrepancy. And Med Ed, of course, had a lot to lose, and their own self-interest made them want for everything to be fine. And I think they tried to report it as if everything were fine.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously everything wasn't fine, still isn't fine.
Did you have any mental pictures of what was going on there at DMI or what might happen?
No, I hadn't, and I saw China Syndrome about maybe 2 weeks ago when I came to the Carlisle Theater.
Uh-huh.
It really was. I did not enjoy seeing it. It brought back all the anxiety that I felt during the crisis. I thought I should see it because it was connected with something that was an important thing in my life, and I should see it. But I didn't enjoy seeing it, and I didn't recommend that Lana see it. And since I've seen it, it's impossible for me to think about Three Mile Island without seeing the films, the China Syndrome film pictures of that control room. Although I know it doesn't probably look at all like that at Three Mile Island. It's one of the insidious things about visual media. But I didn't really have any particular picture of what was going on inside. I obviously knew what the towers looked like. I'd looked at them many times, but I didn't have any mental picture or clear picture. I did find that my ability to understand what was going on inside the core. I did watch one program on television that did a drawing of the core and what was actually going on, and I felt that my ability to understand that was enhanced immensely by my feelings of anxiety. I really could understand what they were saying. I got the picture of the inside of the core and the cooling and all that. I understood it because I had to. I just wanted to so badly. But as far as, you know, any sort of dramatic picture of people scurrying around and all that, I didn't really have that. It was just this floating, horrible fear of the silent death, you know. And I guess that's what my picture would be, much more the pictures that you see, for example. Did you ever see that film Night and Fog?
Yeah.
It's the pictures that were taken of Buchenwald and Auschwitz after after everyone was gone, and they just, it's just a still film, and it's taken in the evening, and you can just recreate in your own imagination. And I guess the images that I had were these silent, desolate images. Same kind.
Did, or do you think that anything that happened at TMI had any effect on your health?
No. I wasn't ever really worried about my own health after I'm 44 years old. Aside from, you know, a Holocaust, you know, I may, in 30 years, I may have bone marrow cancer or something like that. I'll be in my 70s. I can cope with it. I'm not planning to live forever. I really didn't worry about my own health. And I don't feel like, I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't think, certainly no immediate thing for my health, maybe something long-term.
Do you think that it's a real possibility that something long-term?
I don't think that any of us really know yet, because they're still giving, I don't think that we actually know how much radiation was released into the atmosphere. So I really don't know. I'm not terribly concerned about it.
Are you concerned about it for your children?
Yes. I have all girls. I think women are much more vulnerable to damage from radiation. And I'm much more concerned for them. I'm concerned for them if they have children. And they're all very young women.
Are you really upset, or are you, is it something that's just sort of in the back of your mind?
Well, it's in the back of my mind. I don't know what you can, you know, I don't know what, you're powerless. The whole thing is characterized by the powerlessness that I felt, or, and the whole thing, you're powerless, just what can you do about it? You know?
Do you feel like they're kind of ruining your life? Or that the people are just out there and that you just...
Well, you know, it's not they, it's us. You know, it's the way our society... I think basically it's a problem, a religious problem. It's a problem of, it's the same old problem of man's, and when I say man, I mean all of us. Our greatest sin has always been the sin of pride, that we can become like God. And we have moved so far along this path that, in fact, the idea of God is so diminished in our eyes that we don't even think about Him anymore, really. We only think about our acquiring more and more godlike powers. And we're doing this at a tremendous cost to our whole environment. And the Three Mile Island, it was really funny. When you were talking to Melissa on the phone, I just picked up this old chronicle. And it turns out that, for example, the University of Illinois burns radioactive liquid in their power plant. And yeah, this is incredible. Let me just read you this. The University of Illinois has been incinerating its nuclear cocktails, about 100 gallons a month, for about 2 years. This is burned and then diffused into the atmosphere in, and listen to this, concentrations that Mr. Stearman said are, doesn't this sound familiar, well below the limits set by air quality regulation. You know, I mean, Three Mile Island is simply a symptom of our whole society, of our whole willingness at any price to get immediate gratification, and our total disregard for future generations, because we've lost a sense of the past. We have no tradition.
We have no past, so we only have now. Because you can't have a future if you have no past. And so I would say that I'm as guilty as anyone else. We're all guilty of this, to the extent to which we've lost contact with our past. We've lost responsibility, and we don't know who we are. We don't see ourselves in the right perspective. We do not see ourselves as creatures.
Did you, during the, you said you went to a religious service mm-hmm. on Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Did you think about God?
Oh,
during the,
to be sure. To be sure.
How did you think about God?
Well, I thought about God in terms of our radical disobedience. You know, here it is, once again, full-blown, you know, disobedience. There's no point in saying, oh dear God, make Three Mile Island go away. Because there are, after all, laws, natural laws, that any beneficent creator would not tamper with. Man has tampered with those natural laws, and now must pay the price.
So you don't think that God caused any of this?
Well.
Or that God would get involved to write it?
I wouldn't have prayed that. I would only pray for grace.
You mean the ability that we should be able to deal with this?
I would just pray that in some way we could restore our right relationship to a deity.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost that relationship, and if we could restore it, perhaps we certainly can't restore all the wrongs that we have committed when we've been out of a right relationship. But if we could reestablish a right relationship, we might know how to proceed in the future. But to say something, which is not to say that I wouldn't ever ask for any kind of divine intervention to avert a tragedy that was of my own doing. I would only ask that I could cope with it.
Did you think of any particular biblical stories or anything at the time?
Well, it's the Genesis story, isn't it? It's the eating of the forbidden fruit. And it's also Job's story, when God says to Job, can you put this earth, do you understand how this earth has been placed and he asks him about all the natural laws and the stars, and does Job understand all this? And it's almost as if God would say to us that, now do you understand about nuclear energy? Do you understand about the physical laws of the universe? You think you do, eh?
When you went to church Sunday morning, how was it any different that day than it was at any other time?
It was very different for me because, you see, I'm very, very fond of this church. I really love it. I have this great weakness for aesthetically pleasing buildings. It's a beautiful church. And I went to church, and I wasn't going to leave. In fact, I really went thinking I would leave. After I had made my communion, I would go home and leave. So I went very much saying goodbye to this particular church, to this particular time in my life associated with this church, to the people that were there that were part of my life at that time, and actually to the whole, you know, whether I have, but you know, would this congregation
this community of the faithful, you know, would they ever come together again? And there was that possibility that they might not. So I think from that point of view, it was very different. But in other ways, and that's one of the things that's very reassuring about the service. In many ways, it was the same service, so that it provided a continuity in a time of discontinuity.
Mm-hmm. Did you think? I just brought this to mind. If you were to have left, did you think you would have been gone a long time?
Mm-hmm.
That you would not have returned at all, or
if there had been the explosion or the meltdown, we would never probably have come back to this area. So that was one of the possibilities that I thought of, that we wouldn't come back. That even if the buildings were standing, that they would be so contaminated that we wouldn't be coming back to live in this area.
Do you think, just as long as we're talking about religion here, I just have a few more questions, that religious persons or institutions should make any kind of a stand either for or against the development of atomic power?
Yes, I think that religious persons have a special responsibility to raise the moral questions involved with any kind of nuclear power. What are we actually saying when we say we have to have this power? We're saying we have to maintain the lifestyle that we now have developed in this country. But what is so particularly valuable about that lifestyle? What characterizes it? It seems to me the things that characterize it are a kind of rampant consumerism, a kind of obsession with things that we now have, you know, that we must have more of, so that we must have power so that we can turn on these air conditioners and television sets and run these cars. And is this the kind of life that we really want for ourselves and for our children? I think these are the questions that have to be asked. Are these values the values that we really want to live by? And are they so important to us that we're willing to risk contamination of the earth, which is, after all, That is our responsibility, isn't it, as Christians? It's the care of the earth. What kind of care have we taken of it? What kind of care of the garden?
I'm not an Episcopalian, but that's one of the prayers that you have in your church that has always impressed me. I don't know the wording of it exactly, but it's something about taking care of mm-hmm. of our earth, our
mm-hmm.
good earth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And speaking of that, do you have any concerns about eating or drinking any of the food products done in this area? For instance, the milk or anything like that. Are you concerned about
mm-hmm.
it?
Yes. We've tried very hard. During that time, we didn't drink any milk. And I have, I always keep powdered dry milk. Because we had the strontium 90 business when my children were young, and they all only drank powdered milk because the feeling was then that the older it was, the less likely it was to have strontium 90 in it. So we used powdered milk during that time, and since then I've just tried to. Buy milk that's made outside of the Cumberland Valley, not in our valley. But I don't know. It's probably a silly business because everywhere. I mean, since Three Mile Island, we realize that there's all. You know, we're hearing more and more about these places. They're everywhere. So there's really no escape from it.
But where do you go to buy your milk, by the way?
Well, I buy it at the supermarket, but if you look on the milk cartons, there are some that are, you know, not processed in this area, like Lucerne milk. So
you go to Safeway to get your milk?
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, I'm much less careful about that now than I was. Because it just seems the more you read, it's probably, there's wherever they make their milk, who knows, next door maybe. Another Peach Bottom or Three Mile Island, or maybe it's near a university where they're burning their radioactive waste. I do have sort of a creepy feeling about my snow peas. I wonder about them, but I'm eating them.
Did you think that you'd survive this problem, or did you ever think about your own death, for instance, during the crisis?
Oh, I did, but not a whole lot. I mean, of course, that's one of the reasons I wanted to get out, is that I was trying to assess whether or not we were going to have, you know, something that would cause death. And so in that regard, I thought about death, but I wasn't I didn't dwell on it. I think the feeling that a lot of us had were not to concentrate on that, but what was the responsible thing for a mother and a wife to be doing, you know, for the people that she felt responsible for? What was she supposed to be doing? And then, of course, what about all those people that you'd be leaving behind? You know, what was your responsibility to your neighbors? Should you be taking them away, you know, or should you convince them that they should go, or would that be just leading them into greater difficulty? I mean, just the human problems of it, of your responsibility to the people in your life were, I thought, overwhelming.
Do you think that this type of a disaster was any more or less frightening or whatever, than a flood or a hurricane or a war or
It was definitely more frightening than the only, it was definitely more frightening than Agnes was, because during Agnes, we had a sense, we understood what was going on. It was a very simple thing. The rain was falling and the river was rising. And in this area, we were getting a lot of flooding because of streams, and you could understand that, and you knew what to do about it, and you also knew you had enough time, and you understood what the threat was. I've never lived in a war. I would imagine that it would be absolutely terrifying. I've also lived in, because I'm from the Midwest, I've lived through a couple of tornadoes, and you understand what the tornado is, and you understand what its damage will be. You don't know, like the Skylab, exactly where it's going to lie down, but you know what it is that you can do to protect yourself from it. You usually have enough warning to go to the basement, you know, which one to stand in. You may lose your property, but you shouldn't lose your life. And when you get to that point, well, your property becomes very unimportant. So I would say that it was more frightening because you didn't understand the threat, and you didn't have the feeling that anyone was really, even those people that you began to feel were telling you as much of the truth as they knew, you didn't have the feeling that they really understood what was going on, because it had never happened before. So it was the unknown aspects of it, I think, that were most frightening.
What about Skylab?
I've listened to the radio to see when the entry was. And once again, I seem to be beset by having my family all the way. Once again, I'm the only person with the animals at home. And
we're talking about Skylab.
Oh, well, Clark and Margaret are in New York, and Amy's in Canada, and Susan's in Lancaster. So I told everyone, I said, listen to the radio on Wednesday and see what, you know, just be aware that something is going on. I don't feel nearly as apprehensive about that. But it's the same ridiculous thing. I mean, they don't know what they're doing, and they're not telling. I think it's very clear they're not telling us. For the same reason that Thornwell didn't declare an evacuation. Because they feel that if they say, well, now look, the Skylab is going to come down between Philadelphia and New York at 12:45, that everybody in that area will get in their car and try and get out of there, and more people will die because they will have left the area than will if they just stay there. So that's my assessment of why we don't have any more information than we apparently have on Skylab. And it may be that they don't know anything more, but I think if they knew, they probably wouldn't tell us.
Do you feel particularly bothered by the fact that first we have TMI and now we've got Skylab right on top of it?
You mean picked upon it?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've heard the joke about the DC-10. That's one of the first DC-10s that's going to be allowed to fly will be entering the Harrisburg airport just as it's hit by Skylab and crashes into the 3 Mile Island.
I've never heard that one.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, you came up with a couple of good jokes because you sent me those good pieces of serography.
Yeah.
Where did you get those?
What
was the circumstance?
A friend of mine who works in Harrisburg had thought that we might had heard that we were collecting and sent this to me.
Let's see here. You mentioned a couple of things that came to your mind during the crisis. You said that the movie Hiroshima Mon Amour came into your mind, and then the clips of newsreels of the bomb at Hiroshima. Did anything else like that, any other movies, come into your mind? Did you start thinking about those
things? This was a film that I saw during, it must have been shortly after the war. And it had to do with being on a train, and I don't remember the name of the film, but it was I felt very much like I was in that cinema when I came back on the train that day from Philadelphia. I can't think of any other films that I mentioned the Night in the Fog film. I did think about that. Other kinds of catastrophe kinds of films. I can't think of any other films.
Well, did this crisis make you think of any particular crisis in your own past? Or any crisis that...
There was one other time. The beginning of the Korean War, I was in the eighth grade, and it was the summer after I was in the eighth grade, and we had lived in Akron, Ohio, and my parents had moved to Cincinnati, and I was back in Akron visiting friends, and we went into Korea, and I called my parents from Akron and asked them if they wanted me to come home. They thought that was very funny. They said, no, you can stay there. But I had... I guess more than anyone in my family, I have the sense that if there's a crisis, everyone should kind of get together. And I always seem to be away from other people in my family when this happens. So I did think about that, with some sort of amusement. That here, once again, some crisis. We did also, early in our marriage, well, not too early, I guess we've been married 4 or 5 years then, we were in North Carolina during the Cuban Missile Crisis and had two very small children then and saw the planes flying over. I mean, we were on the flight path. And and at that point did some putting of food in the basement and that sort of thing. But I can't say that other than those two incidents, I could think of any other. You know, the crises were always public crises and didn't bring up any personal crises.
You know, it just brought up public ones.
Some subjected thing that we were subjected to by our public nature, yeah.
Well, did you find yourself humming songs or anything like that during the time?
Yes, I was humming Waltzing Matilda.
You were?
Yeah.
That was from...
That was On the Beach, I think, is the name of the movie. But you know, the reason I was humming it is that Lana mentioned that, and we started laughing. But you know, the it's a very subversive song, Waltzing Matilda. And I was sort of thinking about it in the original context of the song, which is, you know, the sort of the rebel within society, and sort of thinking that's really the way you should live your life, independent of these institutions, because you get caught up in these institutions and you get certain things from them, but you pay a tremendous price. Wouldn't it be nice if we could escape to the wilds of Australia and build our little bonfire and be a scallywag man or something, you know?
Well, did you have any daydreams during that time?
No, I can't recall any.
Or how about any sleeping dreams?
I didn't sleep very much. I was, in the worst of it, I was waking up every...
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I think I might have, but I don't recall any of it.
Do you remember any joking from any other crises in the past? Do you remember any black humor type of stuff?
I'm terrible at remembering jokes, Steve. I don't really remember.
Well, do you remember that there might have been, even though you can't remember them, say during the Cuban Missile Crisis, were people making cracks and jokes about the coming of the end or anything like this? So.
Yeah, I suppose. But I don't really remember.
Well, just as sort of the last couple of questions. Would you say that you are anti-nuclear then?
Definitely. I definitely am. I think we haven't invested what we should in solar energy. I think the reason that we haven't is that the corporate structure in this country has not supported nuclear energy, and therefore, I mean, solar energy, and therefore, the government hasn't felt in the position to support it. I haven't changed. Three Mile Island has only deepened that conviction. It hasn't changed it. I had that conviction before Three Mile Island.
Mm-hmm. Well, just as the last thing, is there anything anything else you'd like to say? Anything you'd like to make known through our study here? Or anything you'd like to say about the whole incident? Other than what we've talked about?
No. I really, you know, I think it's very valuable. I think that what you've done in this survey has been a valuable activity that's grown out of a dreadful situation. And I think that that was the most positive aspect of the week, was getting involved and doing some of those interviews and watching you, get people to reflect upon what was happening. I think that's one of the things that we've lost as a people, is a power to reflect. I think that's one of the prices that we pay things like television are that we fill our ears and we fill our eyes with media all the time. We don't have silence. We don't have quiet times. We don't walk. We get in a car and ride, and so we don't have the kinds of reflection that walking give us. We don't go from one place to another over a period of time. We're just instantly there. So that all these things that we've done to speed up our lives,
the price we're paying for them is that we don't reflect on the nature and quality of our lives. And that's one of the reasons why we need these outside stimuli so badly, because we've forgotten how beautiful our lives can be with quiet, with space, with time. And to the extent that you've asked people to reflect, you've given them that back a little bit. So that's good.
What do you think should be the aim or the goal of a study like this? What would you want it to demonstrate, to do? Or?
Well, I think that to personalize something like Three Mile Island, I think one of the most hideous things that I saw was on television in Hartford the morning, I guess it was, it must have been Friday morning. One of those, I think it was, it wasn't a Good Morning America, it was that other one, that other morning show. The Today Show. Yeah, I don't listen to it, but we were listening to it that morning. And they had gone into Harrisburg and interviewed people and said, they'd ask them, are you afraid of what's going on at Three Mile Island? And then they'd come up with some ridiculous statistic, something like 45% of the people interviewed in Harrisburg were not alarmed. And I thought, you know, what? Which means that 55% of the people probably were scared shitless. But at any rate, you know, it was so inhuman. It was like taking these people and asking them, are you alarmed or are you not alarmed, about something that they, a lot of the people that they interviewed were people that were, that they found on the streets of downtown Harrisburg, who probably, I would gather that, I guess that maybe at least half of them hadn't had much beyond an indifferent high school education at best. How could they possibly understand the question or the implications of the question? And so I think that to say, looking at people and when they had a chance to reflect and giving that opportunity to reflect and encouraging them to reflect, and then to say, this is what happens to human beings. This is what the human experience is. This is the human cost that we pay. Because each person that lives in Cumberland Valley is a child of God, an important person. And so 45% or 55% are demonic kinds of concepts. Okay? They're denying the individual special nature of each one of those people who was in any way endangered by this. And I think that to make that point, you know, to make the point of the individual human experience, the human cost, and to present that, it would be a very valuable thing to do. And I think you'll do that. I mean, I'll see how you can avoid it. Because you're not really dealing with statistics, although you're going to put us on the computer.
That's only to help us.
That's what they all say. Okay.
I hope that's what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to be apologizing for taking 2 hours.
2 hours? We're going to do this in a half an hour.
Most people go about 20 minutes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We did 6 interviews a day at the intermediate school.
You couldn't interview me more than once a day, could you?
No.
Gary, I would say that by Wednesday people would be doing exactly what you were saying, releasing tension diet.
You made up the You Light Up My Life t-shirt on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't do something like that on Tuesday.
No, and in fact, Susan Nichols, that was her project, and she kept saying to me, come on, think up something. You know, join the contest. And I think, I mean, it's not funny. I can't think of anything at all. And I don't know why, but at breakfast, when the kids and Clark and I were all having breakfast on Wednesday morning, and I said that, and they all thought it was funny, so I made the t-shirt. I did the t-shirt on Wednesday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until Wednesday morning.
Mm-hmm. So you feel then that it's true that women were able to joke as much as men?
I don't know about that, but I suppose after the tension was over, then I don't see that they would probably be able to make jokes. You know, when they began to feel that the situation was safe again, I would say that they would probably be just able to joke as well as men.
Mm-hmm.
I think women can joke. I mean, they're not humorless.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were even really, look at Lily Tomlin.
Yeah. So it was really an expression of relief of tensions then.
For me, it was. By then, I was feeling, much better by Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. So you're looking at it, you found that there were fewer jokes before Sunday.
Oh, well, definitely. For me, there were no jokes.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people may have been telling them, but I wasn't hearing them. There was no joking at all. But as I say,
until
Sunday evening, after we'd seen The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and we were sitting around, and Sandy and I are both kind of like, we share a kind of joking relationship about our mutual, you know, super mother henning, super worrying about people, being very conservative about when our children are involved, you know, and our husbands are involved, you know, about risk. And we looked at each other and began to be able to laugh, saying, of all the people on earth, you know, who are least able to cope with this kind of tension than the two of us? And here we were, you know, having to cope with it and beginning to laugh about that. Oh, I had another funny thing happen that night. Jim's father had died on New Year's Eve, actually. And since we're close friends, we were, you know, concerned about that and everything. They came from St. Louis, and he went back to St. Louis. And we know a lot about his father, a lot of jokes about his father. He's a wonderful character and everything. And that night, and Jim himself is a wonderful character. He owns a uniform shop that's just reopened out across from the plaza. And lots of the colorful characters of Carlisle come into the shop because they know Jim and they talk to Jim. And he knows all these wonderful stories about wonderful people in town. And he always collects characters. Well, the phone rang that evening, and Lisa, his daughter, went to answer the phone. She says, "Dad." And Sam says to me, they called Jim, and they talked to him, and said, this is one of Jim's characters. So he went up and started talking on the phone. When he came down, he said to us, this was the spookiest experience. A friend of his who lives in San Francisco called Jim that night to tell him that his father, Jim's father, who had died about, you know, that previous New Year's, that his father was very concerned about him. And Jim said to his friend, my father's dead. And he said, I know. But he said, I've been in conversations with him lately, and he's very concerned, and that's why I'm calling you, so that I can assure him when I talk to him next that you're doing all right. And the man in San Francisco, I think, is a little, you know, it's a little deranged. And he didn't even know about Three Mile Island. But he knew, he said, that his father, Jim's father, knew that Jim was in some difficulty, and he wanted this phone call to be made. And it was really interesting, and then of course we all laughed, because Jim has this reputation of having all these strange people that come in and talk to him, and he knows all these sad stories, and he knows all these strange people. We have a lot of sort of marginal people in Carlisle, you probably noticed, and they all come to Jim. He knows all of them. And so here is this boyhood friend. He'd known Jim in St. Louis and known Jim's father, knew his father was dead, and knew his father was concerned. So he said, well, tell my dad, I'm fine. And the conversation, because it was a really bizarre conversation.